Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund.
These priorities can be pretty harsh to determine. To have to forego, you know, important medication because you got to get food.
Has that ever happened to you?
Yes.
At a time of extreme income inequality, we also face health inequality. You're listening to a Humankind special. I'm David Freudberg. I set off on this program seeking answers to a simple but troubling question. Why does poverty tend to shorten a person's lifespan? Public health studies show that the wealthiest Americans live 10 to 15 years longer than those with least income. And the consequences are being felt at this time of drastic income inequality, a level not experienced since Americans first heard the bluesy tunes of the jazz age in the 1920s, a period that led to the Great Depression.
Not since those bygone days of old Joan, I have a person had that luck as mine. Seems that I was born just for sorrow, and the sun on me won't shine.
The effects of health inequality take many forms, some disturbing. Hospital emergency rooms report higher rates of illness and injury for people of low income. And there's little question that trouble paying for medications or just paying for your next meal can take a toll on a person's well-being. I talked with patrons of a food pantry here on the North Shore of Massachusetts in the storied fishing town of Gloucester. Here's Carolyn Curley.
My medications are so high, it's pathetic.
What do you need medications for?
Like a heartburn medicine.
Heartburn medicine?
Yeah. And then I have for your high blood pressure and things like that. And combine them sometimes. I don't have enough money to pay for my meds to keep going, you know.
So what happens on months when you can't afford the meds?
I don't get them. I just skip them. I don't bother getting them. I don't bother taking them.
Is there a noticeable result if you can't get your blood pressure med?
Yeah, my blood pressure goes right to the moon. Like one time it was over 255 over 84.
Wow.
And I went up to the hospital.
Yeah, you could get a stroke from that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't get a stroke, thank God. I have sleep apnea. I have high blood pressure. I'm overweight, as you can see. It's a lot of things.
And this is Massachusetts, a state that led the country in making strides toward universal health care. Here's Doug Goldman, another patron at the pantry.
What age were you diagnosed with diabetes?
34.
And you're how old now?
61. Now, I've been insulin dependent for 20 years.
Yeah. Is it hard to manage all that?
Yeah, extremely hard. You know, some people are really disciplined that way. Right now, I'm on a roll. I'm losing weight. I have this and that going on. I have to have a knee replacement.
Doug has held a variety of jobs, from selling musical instruments to working in the fish department at a local supermarket. At times, he's faced the kinds of choices people make between paying for medicine and other necessities.
You know, these trade-offs are, you don't want to make them. You know, but every, you know, indigent people have to. And there's a lot of that in this country.
Do you regard yourself as indigent?
I live below the poverty level. But no, I don't regard myself really as indigent. I'm okay.
Nationwide, even with more people covered through the Affordable Care Act, nearly 30 million Americans remain without health care. This is Bellevue Hospital in New York City, founded in the 1730s. It's America's oldest public hospital, part of a system called NYC Health and Hospitals, the largest public health care system in the United States. They log in more than 1 million patient visits each year, mostly with people of low income. Physician Dave Choksi leads the system and sees individual patients 2 days a week. Recently, he's been caring for a patient who had suffered a stroke.
She actually woke up one morning and she found that the room was spinning. She actually couldn't articulate the words to describe the symptoms she was experiencing to her husband because of the stroke. And so she was brought into the hospital at that point. And she received very good care and actually is making a very good recovery. But she had undiagnosed high blood pressure, which was likely the major contributor to having the stroke in the first place.
And it's not unusual for a serious medical condition to go undiagnosed. People may avoid doctors to avoid medical bills, or because getting to the clinic may be complicated if you don't have transportation.
She is someone who had immigrated into the United States about 15 years ago, had not seen a physician during that period of time, and had one of the most common medical conditions that exists that could have been treated differently. So I think a lot about those illness trajectories where a different outcome or a preventable outcome could have been reached.
One of the things I have found startling is evidence that children born into poverty tend to have lower birth weights than children born into higher income families. Can you explain why that would be?
Mm-hmm. There are many reasons, but it gets to the idea that the way that poverty and health interacts is not just in one person. It can actually be intergenerational, from a mother to a child, from one family member to another. And so the example of low birth weight shows that for a multiplicity of reasons, again, it could be that the mother didn't have sufficient nutrition during their pregnancy. It could be that they were exposed to toxins, cigarette smoke, other substances that could contribute to low birth weight.
Jacob Bohr of the Boston University School of Public Health.
Following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, babies born to Muslim women were of lower birth weight because of the increased stress that their mothers faced in this atmosphere of Islamophobia in the wake of the terrorist attacks. Similarly, there was lower birth weights were observed among Hispanic women in Iowa following immigration raids there. And those are specific examples where low-income Americans face larger stressors.
So for multiple reasons, from food insecurity to struggling to pay the rent and utilities to social prejudice, living in poverty can contribute to tense, frustrating conditions. Dr. Dave Choksi.
And we're increasingly uncovering that there are mechanisms by which chronic stress can also lead to poor health outcomes, not just for individuals, but across a life cycle and intergenerationally as well.
There is a phenomenon sometimes referred to as toxic stress, which in turn can actually lead to greater inflammation in our bodies, causing an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. Can you help us understand how that works and what it means?
The science of this is still being unearthed, and we are trying to understand the precise mechanisms by which toxic stress leads to adverse health outcomes. But the association is very clear. Toxic stress is the idea that the stress that any of us experience on a day-to-day basis occurs so repetitively and to a certain magnitude that it sort of adds up in a cumulative way that leads to illness and poor health for the person who is experiencing it.
We all know we make different choices when we're stressed.
Lauren Taylor is co-author of The American Healthcare Paradox, which examines why the U.S. spends so much on medical costs, including when the stresses of daily life kind of get under our skin and can lead to health consequences.
We make choices to stress eat, or we make choices to skip things that are important, meetings or doctor's appointments or what have you, Or you're stressed and you forget to do things. You forget to pay the rent on time, or you forget to call the babysitter. And so, you know, stress can have all sorts of impacts on health that are not necessarily under the skin, but are just behavioral.
Stress is something that everyone can understand because we've all experienced it.
Dr. Dave Choksi of New York City Health and Hospitals.
It's, you know, that feeling of your heart pounding. It's insomnia because something is gnawing away at you from the inside. It's headaches, you know, that you can't explain by any biological phenomenon, but you know things have been tough at work or in your family. And all of those are things that if you have enough resources, both material as well as social, you figure out ways to cope with those things on a day-to-day basis. But it's not such a stretch. You know, we don't have to use our imagination so much to think that what if I were experiencing those things relentlessly every single day, you know, how would that change my body and my mind? And that's what a lot of people who are living on the margins, whether because they're poor or for other reasons, experience every day.
People handle the strain of living on the margins in different ways, and not necessarily in healthful ways. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that individuals living below the poverty level have higher rates of cigarette smoking than the general population. Boston University's Jacob Bohr.
I think both tobacco and other substances, including alcohol and including opioids, to some extent serve as coping mechanisms to deal with the stresses that people face in their lives. And I think that's one, you know, partial explanation for why in the last 40 years you've seen such a divergence in terms of smoking rates between richer and poorer Americans. And why with the opioid epidemic, which surely affects all strata of society, but is disproportionately affecting lower income people.
Several studies have shown that low-income youth and adults are disproportionately targeted by fast food advertising. This tends to promote obesity and other negative outcomes. So people who are struggling to make ends meet may be powerfully tempted into making choices that harm their health. Dr. Dave Choksi.
Part of the reason is that when you have a limited income, when you just don't have very many means, you will try to stretch that dollar as far as it will go. And the way that our food system in the United States, at least, has been set up, you know, the cheapest foods are often the least healthy foods. We know that processed foods are not healthy, but they're mass-produced. And they're mass-produced in a way that you can get a lot of calories from a small package. And so from the simple economic perspective, you know, that idea that you get a lot of empty calories for little money is contributing to what we're seeing in terms of overweight and obesity.
People can be obese and undernourished at the same time. And I think that can be a real eye-opener for people.
Lauren Taylor.
You can consume empty calories. You can not get the right micronutrients. You cannot be taking in food at regular intervals. And so then when you do sit down in front of a big pile of food, you overeat because you just have this instinct that you don't know where your next meal is going to come from. And so let's load up now because who knows when it's coming. And so, you know, it's a lot of the things we've talked about in terms of environmental factors that I think contribute to rates of obesity that we see in low-income folks. It's about, you know, is your neighborhood safe to exercise? I have the luxury of being able to go out for a run more or less whenever I want to. If I thought there was active gang violence in my neighborhood, would I feel as comfortable going out for a run? Probably not. And especially maybe not at 9 or 10 o'clock when I get home from my second or third job. Access to food, if I live in a place that is sometimes called a food desert, those are places that don't have usually supermarkets or places with fresh produce, then, you know, where am I supposed to get the kinds of food that would give me the micronutrient profile that I'm supposed to get, and that would keep me feeling full and satiated so I don't go to that vending machine or I don't reach for, you know, whatever the kind of junk food is that next comes into my path.
Examining how living in poverty can be harmful for your health. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, part one of Health Inequality, and to obtain audio downloads or CD, please visit humanmedia.org. Back now to the food pantry in Gloucester, Massachusetts, regularly patronized by people of low income.
For a long time, I tried to get this green card thing and try to get health insurance, but everywhere I turned, I was running into a block wall.
This is Dale Harris, originally from Barbados in the West Indies. He says he works part-time and has lived in the United States most of his life, but has problems with his green card registration, which limit his access to some public services.
I've been here since the age of 12, you know, so, you know, I pay taxes and everything, you know, and this is the treatment that I get, you know, and after a while, you know, that gets irritating after a while. It does things to a person's well-being, to their thinking and their judgment. So you got to be. You got to be very careful, and you have to have a whole lot of patience, you know, to go through this.
Well, I'm sure that's certainly true. So are you saying that it can be stressful for you?
Yes, at times, you know, especially when everywhere you turn, people tell you to go do this way, go here, go there, and every time you do that, there's a block wall that's stopping you, you know, just because of a couple of numbers, you know. So.
Numbers on a green card, for example?
Yes, exactly, that's what I'm talking about, yes. You know, I've got the numbers, but they just want the proof, you know, because of all this stuff that's going on with the borders and stuff like that. I don't blame them, you know, but you know, some of us have been here for their whole lives, you know, and we should be allowed, you know, to have access to a lot of stuff. We don't get nothing, you know.
And it's not just frustrations with the bureaucracy. Dale's ability to afford medicine is also on the line. When we met, he was up against several serious health problems.
For a long time, I didn't have access to any of my medication and stuff because I didn't have the insurance. And then I went to try to get it by paying cash for it. And that's outrageous, you know, because for a month's supply of one medicine that I have, it's over $200. It's $240-something just for 90 pills. You know, like, what? How is that going to work? So I have to pick and choose every month what do I pay or whatever, you know, because I have high blood pressure too, you know, and I have to have that medicine, you know, so every day. So, and that's where I've been for a long time, stuck like that.
Have there ever been times when you just skipped the meds because it was too expensive?
Yes, I skipped the meds for a long time, for years, because I couldn't afford it, you know, so, you know, so, and I was lucky by the grace of God, you know, that I didn't drop dead because of it, you know. You know, so I had to be very careful what I do and how I reacted, keep my stress level down, that way my blood pressure don't come flying through the roof, you know. So
what do you do to keep your stress level down?
I just try to stay as calm as possible. Stay as calm as possible and try not to let anything get to me too bad, you know. If that do happen, you know what? I just hit the door and go outside for an hour or two, you know, and just go down by the water and just hang out, you know.
Well, you live here by the ocean, so that can be very therapeutic.
Yes. That's a benefit in itself right there, you know, because we live by the ocean. We've got the million-dollar view every time I get up, you know.
Million-dollar view. Well, the Gloucester and Rockport have those, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Well, here, all over, you know. So. Here on Cape Ann. Professionals are increasing.
increasingly aware of the importance to our health of the lifestyle choices we make. Our attention to diet, to exercise, and to stress management, self-care, are areas where individuals have some personal choice. But for health caregivers, supporting healthful choices can be a matter of careful timing. Physician Dave Choksi at Bellevue Hospital in New York.
The patient I was seeing last week, who I just remember very vividly, this is a patient who had recently been hospitalized with a very serious infection. She had had an amputation within the last year. You know, it was related to her smoking. And so top of my problem list was helping her to quit smoking. For her, she was so clearly concerned about her son, who lives outside of the United States, who was suffering with health issues of his own. And she wanted to tell me about those health problems, and she wanted to talk through them with someone. And this was so clearly a source of distress for her, and something that, I had to kind of shelve my agenda so that I could bear witness to what she was most concerned about.
What a powerful insight to bear witness, which may or may not also be accompanied by advising the patient. But you play a role in that context in merely honoring the human dilemma?
That's right. And it's, it's of course an extraordinary privilege to get the windows into people's lives that we do as clinicians. But I find that bearing witness will have a tangible impact for the patient as well, in the sense that it allows us to talk as two humans, you know, for me to gain some insight into what her values are and what is, you know, top of mind for how she thinks about how she's going to organize her time and her life. And it's just a more realistic way for me to think about what it is that I can offer to support her in navigating the journey, you know, to improve her own health. We didn't get to talking about smoking cessation during that appointment. We might not get to it at the next appointment either. But I think particularly as I've gained more experience as a clinician, you learn that that's okay. And these are the small, you know, seemingly intangible ways in which you foster trust with people who will then endow you with the chance to walk with them in, you know, whatever it is that they want to do to improve their own health. And so I think it's far more likely in the medium to long term that she and I will have a conversation about her smoking in a way that is resonant with her and where she will perhaps take me more seriously than another clinician in the past because I've been shoulder to shoulder with her in these other struggles in her life.
As we've discussed, it's hard contending with health challenges amid financial hardship. Rob Lawrence, himself a Gloucester healthcare worker, faced this dilemma in his family.
My oldest sister, 5 years older, her name was Mel. Mel had diabetes, and as time went on, she lost 2 legs to diabetes. She lived in Louisville, Kentucky. And she would call me all stressed out, sometimes crying on the phone about the medical care, not getting appropriate medical care from hospitals and doctors.
Although surrounded by loved ones, Rob's sister had a hard life in her final years, a fact that was difficult for Rob to bear from a distance.
She suffered, and the church would help, and friends and family would help her pay for the things she needed. And then, unfortunately, she got cancer, and that just made things worse. And she died 6 years ago from the cancer. But in her fight, she always kept a positive attitude, and she had a strong belief in God. But I was shocked at the thousands and thousands of dollars and the costs that they expected a disabled person to pay.
This is the stark reality faced by so many Americans, given the current limitations of our system of healthcare financing. The kind of wrenching dilemmas that have roiled our national debates over who gets medical care and who pays.
I do remember she needed $800 before one doctor she needed to see would see her. And I remember I sent her a couple hundred and her church paid the rest. And she got to see the doctor needed. But I'm thinking to myself, I didn't want to stress my sister. I'm like, I can't believe that you would have to go through this to get a medication that you need to live from a doctor.
And this was a cancer med at that point?
It was, yes.
And she had already suffered the amputations?
Yes, the amputation. She was already without legs.
So in a very compromised position.
Yes, and her husband had to quit his job to take care of her. So that made things worse. He was a very hardworking man, carpenter, fisherman. I give him a lot of respect. He really worked hard to take care of my sister. She had a very loving church, a lot of great people around her and her children and her husband. And
what was the kind of cancer?
Brain cancer. And also she developed a stomach cancer.
Wow.
So she was fighting, you know, it was horrible.
Yeah.
I'm sure other people probably dealt with that. Just the pain and suffering one goes through.
Suffering faced by many families in the cycles of life. The moral question and the fiscal question is, how do we respond? Boston University's Jacob Bohr.
These are choices that we make as a society in terms of the funding levels that we put to these programs and whether we want to make them accessible. And you saw this with Medicaid expansion, and you saw this with the ways that different states approached the way that they made Medicaid available to people or not, in terms of the way that they advertised, in terms of the enrollment periods, in terms of the extent to which they had to document various things. And so the complexity is a barrier, but the extent of that barrier, how high that barrier is a choice. And it's a choice about, fundamentally, it's a choice about what we feel like we owe each other in the society that we want to live in.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Doug Sugarts. Editorial assistance from Miles Blackwood Robinson, Kathy Graham, and Ken Rogers. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to David Cruz and Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media.
You can hear more episodes of our series at humankindpodcast.org. That's humankindpodcast.org.
This segment, part one of Health Inequality, is Humankind program number 268. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review at Apple Podcasts or another podcast service. It goes a long way in helping people find the Humankind series. And you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook, or check out our YouTube channel for full episodes of the podcast. Again, the title is Humankind on Public Radio. Finally, if you'd like to support this podcast, please go to humankindpodcast.org and choose how you can help at the top of our homepage. That's humankindpodcast.org. Thanks.